one, two,
I love three, to count.
Four, that'd be a good way to count in your head when you're doing music. All right, welcome to episode 35 of Chasing Sound.
Chasing Sound, motherfuckers. Kirk and Andrew and a guest. Introduce yourself, man.
Hi, I'm Charles Pruitt.
What is your profession, sir?
I play the cello all night long.
What do you do cello-wise? Tell us a little bit about what your current status is.
Well, this is my 20th season with the Austin Symphony.
Uh-huh.
Came back to Austin in 97, got in the symphony here, and that's what most people know of me. Mm-hmm. But actually, my other, probably best known, the thing that I do, apart from that, is I play Bach. I play solo Bach. The reason I play solo Bach is because when I was living in Maine in 1985, I moved there in 83, and I'd go see this guy who studied violin making in Cremona. His name was John Cooper. So He had a cello one time. He wanted me to play it because he's a fiddler. He doesn't play cello, so he could hear it. I kept playing this cello for, I don't know, the next 2.5-3 hours. I didn't stop playing the cello, and I wanted to get to buy it, but I didn't have the money for it. So I found some people eventually about, I think I saw that in the fall of 84, and it was at a Bach celebration. It was Bach's 300th birthday, 6 hours of Bach. It was broadcast on
a Bach block.
Yeah, right. A block party for Bach, and it was at the St. Luke's Cathedral, that's just the Episcopal Diocese in Portland, Maine.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went on at 11 o'clock, and I played Suite Number 1,
mm-hmm.
and it went really well. It got broadcast on Maine Public Radio. Up to this point, I found out from the section of the church when I would go practice there that this guy named Joel Martin, who is the senior warden at that church, also had been the president of the board of the symphony at Portland,
mm-hmm.
Portland Symphony. And
Were you going to school at the time?
I was studying at University of Southern Maine with the Portland String Quartet, because I used to go there since like 78 when I was in high school. I'd go there for this string quartet workshop they do at Sugarloaf, Maine for 2 weeks. And so when I moved there, and they started calling me Texas Charlie because they couldn't remember how to, you know, say my name.
That's right. You're native Texan, right?
That's right. Yeah.
What part of Texas were you born in?
Born in Dallas.
Okay.
Yeah. Born
Dallas
in
proper or?
Highland Park is where we were living. And my dad was doing his residency in neurology, and I was born at Baylor Hospital. And ironically, my grandparents met each other at Baylor, and my mother eventually got a job at Baylor.
Classic Texas beginnings right there.
Yeah, yeah.
Baylor is where, their motto is where fun goes to die.
Oh, man, you know that my grandparents had to go and meet off campus because you weren't supposed to be allowed to date. So they'd have to sneak across campus somewhere and meet each other.
I've heard stuff like that. Yeah,
yeah. And dancing was not allowed at Baylor.
Oh, Baptists do not like dancing.
Well, just Texas in general. A&M doesn't have cheerleaders. Like, it's an interesting world
right.
in Texas, you know.
Yeah, so aside from a very small period of time with this thing called Nebraska Panhandle Symphony.
Mm-hmm. Are you going to get your phone, Andrew?
I just realized my phone's on.
Okay. All right. He's going to go get his phone.
He's going to check his Instagram.
But back to where was I? I was up in Portland, Maine, right? And we got off on my background.
So you were flying from Texas to Portland, Maine for this
quartet workshop.
This quartet workshop. What? How the fuck did you end up in that?
Back to Baylor. That's how I went. That's my connection to these people in Maine, mm-hmm. because my cello teacher, he started the Houston All City Youth Orchestra. He ended up being hired as the orchestra director at Baylor, and the cello professor, Harry Lance, was my cello teacher. Okay. And so he enabled me at age 13 to go play with Baylor Symphony, and I got out of school 2 days out of the week, so I could go practice on Tuesdays and Thursdays early. I'd get out.
Oh, awesome.
And yeah, to go practice with the Baylor Symphony. So my 13-year-old colleagues were calling me Baylor, Harvard, Yale.
I'm sure. Anyone that does like early college stuff gets fucked with.
Yeah. So I didn't really have that much of a social life in those days. I was always practicing.
Yeah.
But anyway, so Harry's son was the second violinist in the Portland String Quartet. They had come down here, in fact, and played you know, as a quartet that we did Elgar's variations. What is it called? Adagio and Allegro.
The Nimrod variations.
No, no, it's a piece for quartet and orchestra.
Oh, okay.
And I think it's called Adagio and Allegro. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But we played that, and we played another work mm-hmm. with them. So they had a cellist become sick, and they needed somebody to fill that spot. I just had a hernia operation. I went up to Maine, and that was my, you know, tie-in with them in the early going.
Yeah.
Then I was like, parents wouldn't allow me to move there until, you know, I was of mm-hmm. age. So I moved there when I was 20. And that's how, when I got to Maine, and I heard from the sexton at that church that this attorney had, you know, remarked favorably on my performance. I sought him out. He answers the phone, and I go, this is Charles Pruny. He goes, oh, the cellist. And yeah. And so I went up to this guy's sixth floor, back bay view of Portland Harbor.
Nice.
Office, you know, and he's asking me what I think about the cello, and I tell him, and, you know, it's this nice old cello. And this cello had this amazing bow made by Sartori mm-hmm. during the golden period. I don't have the bow.
We'll include, with our selfie that we take for this episode, we'll include a shot of this gorgeous dark wood cello you got here.
It's made around 1850. It's unlabeled, but we sent it down with this bow maker who, in fact, I have one of her bows. Her name is Lynn Hannings, and she took it down to Boston. And this guy named Bradley Taylor there said that he considered it to be of a school of violin making in Prague. Mm-hmm. Around 1850. So we called it Prague Cello, and he incorporated it, and so that was part of my deal with the lease of the cello. My investment in the cello is I worked all summer 60 hours a week, and then I paid for the restoration. It was in pieces for 6 months.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I would do an annual solo concert playing this cello, all from that Bach performance mm-hmm. that introduced me to that guy.
And it's like, I don't know that any guitar player, bass player, blues, whatever, just, you know, any normal band people will understand. So, like, for a guitar player, you think of, like, a 59 gold top Les Paul, right?
Yes.
What that would set you back. But then when you get into cellos, something like this, there's really, other than, like, maybe a Martin acoustic from the 1800s, there's really no basis of comparison for cost and intricacy.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's a foreign thing unless you
and
are
certainly,
a string player
right.
at the symphony level, basically, or at least that caliber of player.
It's, yeah, it's certainly nothing you would, like, gig and take on the road,
yeah.
you know, like
or
in
if
a
you
rock
did,
band sort of situation.
You're checking something of a value that's hard to even put a number on. It's like you're checking a house or something.
Yeah, and this thing has been, I've had it for 31 years, and I'm busy finishing off the other half of it that I still don't own yet. Mm-hmm. I've gained probably 25 or 30% what I hadn't owned before mm-hmm. recently, but it's, you know,
it's a lifer.
Yeah, exactly. So the dude who helped me start it is the only guy I hadn't paid off yet. The other three or four are all taken care of.
And then when you play other cellos and go back to this one, what would you say, like, some of the biggest differences are?
Biggest difference between, like, an old cello like this and
specifically
and
that one and say, like,
and
that
yeah,
one on the
yeah,
wall.
Right. Well, it's that it's played in, it's response. You know, an old instrument has had those tones wind out of the instrument, which is what, when an instrument has just been made, it needs to be played in. Mm-hmm. And that, and when those tones are, it gives it a responsivity that makes it so much easier, warmer sound. Mm-hmm. You actually have to kind of maybe play with a little, work a little less at it, you know, mm-hmm. and you get more. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I remember there was a Guadagnini that my cello teacher had. His son has it now since his father died. And I was playing some Bartok. We were reading some Bartok with him because I sat in with the Portland Quartet for a few months and acting cellist with them. But yeah, it was so easy to play that you actually had to, it felt like butter in your hands, mm-hmm. the pizzicatos from that cello.
Yeah, and it's like when you try to describe wood absorbing tone over decades to someone who doesn't play, you sound like a fool. It's like you're talking about ghost stories or something.
Yeah.
But it's like, but it means something.
It does.
When you play an old instrument, it's like, yeah, it's got a story to tell you.
I think they try to analyze it. They're always wondering, what are the
with
secrets?
With lasers and shit.
Well, they're
yeah,
always
yeah.
saying, well, is it the varnish that gives mm-hmm. it that sound? But I don't think it's really the varnish. I think what it was is that Well, they speculate. I've watched one of the shows that where they say that the in those days wood traveled down the river, mm-hmm. you know,
right,
and that somehow the molecular density of the wood is treated some way that way. But also, you know, after they make the violin or they stain it, they also leave it in the sun, you know, to dry.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. so. But really, really, when you think about it, the craftsmanship that they go to, when you look at the top of this cello, it's so beautifully, it's there. It has less wood in it, so it's a lighter, I mean, mm-hmm, you can, right. as far as cellos go, you probably have held a cello before,
You
Andrew.
Can even tell by looking
at it. Does it feel a little lighter than an average cello to you?
It definitely feels lighter than the average cello. And if you look at the grain, too, the grain is wicked tight. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, the grains on the top, when they're too wide, they don't, I don't think they work as well. Mm-hmm. It's usually a spruce. The side and the back and the,
even the
and
back, the grain is
the back
very
is
tight.
Gorgeous, almost a flame.
You know, and that's another thing. The other big difference between older instruments and modern instruments is that the wood quality that they had to draw from in the 1800s. Mm-hmm. is, you know, probably 10 times what it was.
And the
now.
Time...
Because there's so much... I mean, they were living in old-growth forests.
Right.
You know? Uh-huh. Now we have to drive, you know, miles to see an old-growth forest, and we probably can't cut it down.
Right.
And there's thankfully. No mass production. You know? Like, people, craftsmen took their time because there was nothing but time.
Well, you there's know? That, too.
You're not checking your Twitter. Yeah. You're not fucking right. running to the grocery store. Like, you got one commission, and you're going to work on that thing maybe for a couple of years, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so you just, yeah, you get amazing woodwork. And that, also, that's the other, yeah, exactly. It's like, when the only technology is working wood, mm-hmm. Like, what year is this again?
Around circa 1850.
Okay, 1850, so we're pre-industrial revolution. Yeah. So, you know, there's metalsmithing and stuff like that, but, you know, mostly, most
had
things...
had some crude tools by then, but it was still, you're touching wood a lot.
Well, no, I mean, they had amazing, I'm sure they had amazing tools for woodworking at that point, because that, you know, like, most things in your life are made out of wood, you mm-hmm. know, like, what was made out of metal would be, you know, special things like...
But no, like, bandsaw, or did they have a manual?
Oh, sure, they had manuals, they had saws and stuff like that. I
like
mean,
circular blade saws?
Probably, of pedal pushed kind of things, but mm-hmm. but when you get to cello working, you're dealing with much finer tools. Mm-hmm. You know, after the rough cuts to make the big
are the F holes smaller on this than normal?
Well, you know, it might appear that well, partly because it's a darker stain.
That's
on
what
this.
I'm thinking.
It could
kind
be,
of swallows
a but you know, the if you look at this, some cellos, you know, they vary in size a lot. You know, I think with the violin, that was also the case. The violin family that the cello comes from, that. They hadn't yet standardized the proportions that were acoustically working the best. And Amati did this with the violin. Well, in the case of the cello, Stradivarius did. Mm-hmm. And so if you look, there's another, well, there are many good Montagnanas that were, you know, very, very viable on the same level. I mean, like, as of the top level instruments. I think Montagnana was a Spanish maker, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe he's Italian.
I'll look it up.
No, but it sounds Spanish to me. I don't really know. But yeah, but anyway, about the Montagnana, it has a wider,
I want a nice,
lower bout.
I want a nice cello Montagnana.
Yeah?
You know? Like
yeah.
Tomorrow morning.
Okay, yeah. Sure.
How about that?
But with the Strad, it's a little narrower in general, so that mm-hmm. that actually helps also with the gaps here, so that they're not quite as wide. A very nominal difference. But you know, the proportions were more standardized by Strad, and the guy who I got this cello from said he looked at it. He looks like a Strad model cello. Mm-hmm. But they were trying to use that as
templates or the style.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was looking to. You only have two fine tuners. Do you not use the fine tuners? For
well,
the,
as you notice,
strings?
The bottom two strings are gut, so
yeah,
there's
yeah.
a loop that doesn't really work on the. And you know, that's also. When you're tuning the low strings on with gut, you're either pulling it out here or pushing in there mostly. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can make larger adjustments here, but that's my fine tuning as I do this or push in up there mm-hmm. with the gut.
So you're either stretching the string back over the nut or pulling it towards the headstock.
Right, by pushing this way. That's mm-hmm. But yeah, I like the. I've always used Gut because my teacher could get them for me. He just got me hooked on them since I was 13. And they just, they're warm. I think that, I don't know, there's the guy who plays, or he played in the Beaux-Arts Trio. I think the Guarneri Quartet is even stopped playing. He was in that group too. Mm-hmm. Peter Wiley, I was getting some coaching with him. And he said he thought that the Gut strings on the bottom probably open up the high end of the cello a lot.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense when you think of the elasticity of Gut.
Strings make such a huge difference in general. Like a new set of strings, it's like a new instrument sometimes if you make a radical enough change.
Yeah.
Like in guitar world, we have like flat wounds and different materials. You can get different coatings and things.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't do, we like to do a timeline on this show of musical, basically, digestion over the years, starting from maybe the first record that really moved you, classical or otherwise.
Well, my parents had recordings of Toscanini's Beethoven symphonies. Mm-hmm. And
these are vinyl, or were they doing...
Yeah, vinyl, yeah. These are 33 and a third vinyl.
Mm-hmm.
And I listened to lots of those. I would say that as far as the cellist went, one of the early cello recordings that I heard a lot, and in fact I had met him, this guy, he toured with a group, they called it Solisti di Zagreb, he was Hungarian.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Antonio Janigro. Mm-hmm. Maybe you say Janigro, but I think it's Janigro.
That sounds pretty good, yeah, sounds
yeah,
right.
And he was really, he would do these transcriptions of a Bach violin concerto, and he would conduct from the cello that group, mm-hmm. apparently. But he was really a phenomenal cellist, and those were really beautiful recordings, I remember. And then, of course, Mstislav Rostropovich would, you know, I saw him playing with Academy at St. Martin in the Fields and on TV, and of course I got those recordings. And
yeah.
And you can't deny that there's a certain warmth. I don't know if that it's something technical about Casal's playing, but it's maybe just you can feel a soul when he plays.
Yeah,
you know?
It makes all the difference.
Casal's has a filter that's very Casal's.
Right. Yes.
And some people dislike that about it because they
think that maybe he's a little rough in terms of like he's not as refined maybe and
well,
on some sort of ridiculous perfection kind of technique thing.
That's just it,
but that's,
right?
But who cares really? When it really gets down to it, the best music isn't based around technique. It's based on the interpretation, right?
There's a reason Steve Vai is not held in the same light as Jimi Hendrix.
Oh, yeah.
Technique isn't everything. You need to go from heart to hands without worry about perception of other people.
Right, right.
And you feel it when somebody's playing that way.
Yeah, and sometimes you can hear those guys, you can hear them moan on the recording, which is cool. It's kind of, you can hear them, they're into
passion,
it, you know, and their body, and there's something like, there's almost like an animal side that comes out.
And you get the feeling if they had a broken banjo with one string, they could get you something. Like, they could move you somehow with any skill level or you know, there's just something about playing with emotion.
Yeah, there is, and when something moves you, I think that's what live performance does, and I think that's what makes this city great. Is there's so much live performance going on. There's so much jamming.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many great musicians. So many different kinds.
Oh man, 100 new bands start every day.
You can hear people doing their own music. They're doing music from another corner of the world. They're doing their take of Eastern European or Balkan style, whatever you want to call it. He and I occasionally were in the same circle with some people who do Mediterranean style music, and that's a very large Mediterranean. I mean, you could be any kind, really. It could be
North African, Spanish.
It could be
Moors. Maybe we play Mediterranean music, like when we play Vivaldi.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
You know, like Italian music.
Yeah, it's sort of a minimalism of its own kind. But
it's the center of the old world, really. You know,
But I'm sitting with this group that will do a concert on November 17th, in fact, that it's directed this year by Roberto Riggio of Attache. And I go to this jam every Monday, you know, almost every Monday that I can make it, that he started over at Halcyon. I kept going to hear Roberto. After a third or fourth time, he kept saying, "Bring your axe. Where's your axe?" And so I finally did, and that's really been my therapy, is playing by ear, and improvising, and I've learned a lot better to maybe refine your intuitive skill and kind of calm your kind of classically trained
analytic
again back to the technique, right? Yeah. And then kind of just center, and you know, I mean, my ear's trained. I'm a cellist. I have to follow a chord pattern, and you know, he's given me that even from the very beginning. He said, you know how to hold down a bass line, so that's very helpful. If you've been studying music, they drive it into your head. This is what the form of it is, and then you listen. If you sit in a symphony like I have for nearly 40 years, then you get used mm-hmm. to hearing what's going on around you. You've got to be with what your section's doing. You've got to be mm-hmm. in time with the conductor. Mm-hmm. Well, you've got to be in time with the entire ensemble.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Hopefully the ensemble and the conductor are agreeing on that. Yeah. But you can't always look up there and expect that's going to be what's happening at the very second. You've got to be right here with what's going on in your hands, with what's happening mm-hmm. around you.
And you need a little bit of sway too.
And you got to toe that line too, because mm-hmm. because if you get dragged along by some of the people who think they're going to be late and they're playing a little on the front of the beat, then mm-hmm. that doesn't work.
Yeah,
it's right. Got to be a grounded rhythm. In fact, I remember.
Yeah, it's got a groove. Like that's one of the big things that I try to carry back into my classical playing whenever I get the chance, is that there is, like, every music has to have a groove. Yes. Like, there has to be a, 'cause to me, what it is it's about, like, consistency and predictability for the listener, and that's the trance that music puts people in. Right,
the repetition. It's because it keeps hypnotizing
you. And in classical music, often, because there is, you know, because we live in a post-Beethoven world, mm-hmm. and there is a strong, a lot of weight put on constant variation in the sense of, like, pitch variation, harmonic variation, going to new keys, blah, blah, blah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Hammering the tonic and then eventually getting to the
bottom. But what gets lost often is that, you know, everything still has to have a rhythmic groove. Mm-hmm. And when you get into those new sections, that must be clear and obvious and be able to... Because I think that's the more basic kind of level that people listen to music on, the beat and the mm-hmm. rhythm. Is the most basic thing that we comprehend, right?
Like, right.
That's and whereas and pitch and harmonies are kind of like ethereal, higher things, you right. know, and they're not as easily. It's not as easy to kind of like put someone into that kind of trance like state with, right? You know, you could do it with just a drum.
True. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And you can feel yeah. that.
And anyway, so sometimes
the
like
pulse.
To finish this, like with an example, concrete example is like playing really good Bach, is to me like you're creating like this musical machine that is very clear and just chugging along, and it's got this groove, and you don't with Bach, that's one of those things, like Bach never leaves
right.
a groove uh-huh. over a long period of a...
It's true, he does.
He's a pre-Beethoven composer.
I think if you're listening to Bach, when you're playing it, and you should be listening to it as you're playing it, because that's really what I think you're doing when you're playing Bach, is you're training your ear uh-huh. to be... well in pitch and in time.
Yeah.
But really, he's such a master architect that you right. cannot miss the outlines of the harmony. He does these pedal points, these mm-hmm. these resting where you can find the chordal shape. And you all the time you're listening to Bach and you're finding that actually at the root of most of his music is the circle of fifths.
Sure. Yeah.
And so that's yeah. what I'm talking about, is you can find that place in that moment, and that's where it makes sense to give a little bit of time, and not something where you stretch and drag things out, but you reflect, you hear this dominant key, this new key, and this mm-hmm. left turn, right turn that he did with the harmony in a within a framework that allows it to breathe.
Right.
You know, that's what I think you're talking about when you hear that. It transcends and it helps, it opens your soul, you know.
But yeah.
Yeah, his, and well, even things like thirds, he's constantly building stuff.
Well, and
thirds,
I think that's what, know? Well, my point is also that I think a lot of times in classical music, what kind of messes up the groove is this kind of like individual interpretation when you have a large group of people and everybody's got their slightly different individual interpretation of pitch and rhythm. And, but they, and they haven't ever been, if you listen to a lot of like non-Western jammy music, improvised music, there is, a concerted effort usually to make the whole thing work together.
Right? Yes, when everyone's listening together. Listening. Yeah.
And that happens. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying this never happens in classical music, but it's something that's not always in our society, in our you know,
consciousness,
like, in our consciousness, and it shows sometimes, you know. And so like you play a piece like, you know, like even if you're just like a string quartet doing, you know, like Bach's, I used to play the double concerto and play the slow movement from the double concerto
for
two violins.
Beautiful piece.
And, and that thing just, it just grooves the whole time in the same space, and it never stops until it finally ends. And if you can't hold that groove the whole time, you know, it's not quite the same as
that's a good point. And you know, and I think that's something you feel physically, right? You know, that rhythm.
Yeah.
And, or as they would say on American Bandstand, an old show, Dick Clark would ask one of the contestants, what do you like about this music? What is it? What? And they say, it's got a good beat and you can dance to it.
Right.
Well, you guys were talking about like the basics of the drum a minute ago. The thing about the groove, beyond anything else, is that you can make a two-year-old who doesn't even understand dance, can't even say the word dance maybe, you can make them groove. If you put on a good drum beat,
that's right,
or even a hand drum, the little butt starts shaking.
Yeah.
It's involuntary, and that shows where your pulse is at.
Right.
Like, that shows how tied we are into, you know, our heart is a beat.
Yeah. I mean, when you think about it, actually the first music I was dancing to, when you asked me what was like probably the first thing, as a probably old enough to be interacting with the music, was probably the Beatles, because, you know, when it was the mid 60s and we were in Houston, we hadn't yet moved to Austin, parents split up, we were in Houston for a short while, and I would dance to, you know, I Want to Hold Your Hand or whatever, and it was basically like this. I was standing still, but I could feel the music in me, you know.
Yeah,
and
you're bobbing up and down.
Yeah, you can't fight that. And let's face it, that's what was on the airwaves more than anything was,
or like
the Beatles.
Their version of Twist and Shout, like, I defy you to not have a good time.
Yeah,
that song is on.
Dun, 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 dun.
And the scream, the Beatles brought that explosive chorus, and then just beautiful melodies and those simple two-part harmonies. That was my first obsession.
The screaming that you could hear going on in the background, that was the liveness of it. You know, the girls and the crowds that were so wired to see them.
Yeah, like that
you couldn't
with the
possibly
Hollywood Bowl,
miss the Beatlemania, right? You couldn't possibly miss that.
Well, I mean, I missed it. I wasn't alive.
But it was still presented.
You can still YouTube it now, right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you didn't even need it. I mean, that's the thing. Everyone's parents had the Beatles, no matter
but
what they were into.
Another group that was kind of in the same era that I was awesome, what we listened to a lot, was called Paul Revere and the Raiders.
Oh, yeah.
I know that was that was awesome. Those guys had the costumes.
Yeah.
And, you know, the what do you call those things? A mullet, you know?
Yeah.
And they had those funny ruffled sleeves with the with the ascot.
What's
that called in the front where the sort of puffs out like...
Yeah, it is an ascot.
Yeah, it's an ascot, right. Yeah,
what was their big ass hit? Did they
I'm looking it up.
This is Brown You Have. Was that one of theirs?
Let's see. They were a rock band in the 60s and early 70s. What was their song? I'm trying to remember because I know we know it. Oh, here we go. Kicks,
and Hungry.
Yeah. Hungry, me. Hungry for that feeling, yeah. Baby.
Kicks is like a real
fine girl get, like you.
Kicks that, keep getting...
That, does that have a groove in it or what? Yeah, hungry yeah. for that... I mean, you can't fight that feeling, you know?
Yeah, they were similar to the Animals, Dave Clark 5.
And you could hear some harpsichord occasionally in the background they would use. So they were a British band, were they not?
Because
that's where most of the pop groups were coming were from. American. Called the British Invasion, right?
They were an American band, but they guess they were...
They tried to look British. A lot of bands did that.
Yeah, they kind of... They were from Boise, Idaho.
Boise, Idaho.
Yeah. There was a Texas band.
Oh, really? Wow.
This Texas band led by Doug Song in the 60s that went fake British. Like, there were black guys and Mexican guys in the band, so on the cover of the album, they shaded their faces so you couldn't see them, and they called themselves the Sir Douglas Quintet.
That's right.
And their first album they called The Best Of, so they could sell more copies.
Yeah, Doug Song was a genius.
Genius of marketing, yeah.
But, you know, whether or not a band was British or not... One thing you could hear in the voice, when they sing things, they don't sing the consonants or the vowels, more importantly the vowels, with a hard short vowel. They would round it off like, you know, it just had kind of a roundness to it, the vocal quality that you probably could hear from.
A little bit better for singing.
Yeah, maybe. For the the way the Brits were doing it. But not to say that was a tradition. It was only tied to the Brits. But anyway, you could hear that in the pop songs. You know, that people would sort of round off that. They wouldn't pronounce it the way we would speak it.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know? It would be for a musical effect.
Yeah, instead of me, you say may. And it's like, yeah.
Yeah, meh.
Yeah.
Meh. And now that means something else today. Meh. Right.
Yeah, it depends on context.
But man,
what about other contemporary music? Where, like junior high and high school, what were some of your bands, or if you were even into that?
Well,
sort of thing?
I wasn't doing that necessarily, but my brother, who's a singer songwriter, his name is Chris. He would always be playing stuff like Jackson Browne or Billy Joel. That was probably the number one. Guy I heard a lot in junior high school was Billy Joel. His hits were coming out constantly. And Elton John, still eight, Elton John's hits, I was playing, you know,
Goodbye Yellow Brick Road.
Honky Chateau was one of that albums. That, I think the first album I probably ever got was Yesterday and Today or something like that, the Beatles.
Did you get into specific Billy Joel albums, or were you just hearing what your brother was playing?
Well, it's just that if you're riding around in the car, I'm sorry, I don't think you're going to listen to two singer-songwriters more than Billy Joel and Elton John.
Yeah.
And in fact, when I was, before I got married, I was married to this Romanian, and when we were driving in the car, I would point out to her, this is Billy Joel, and she knew who that was, because, you know, everybody in Europe's listening to pop music, too, so they probably are familiar with it.
Yeah,
but, and those two in particular had such a mass appeal. They were writing killer songs.
Yeah, I think The Stranger, that album, I mean, has a lot of
Turnstiles, stuff. The Stranger. It was just like a cluster in the 70s where he just, like, him and Elton John just couldn't miss. They were just doing such good work at the time.
Yeah, and apparently he had quite a strange life, but, you know, I think...
It's an interesting life, yeah, for sure. He got fucked over by some people. more than a few times.
Have you ever seen that picture of a group he played in? His first band.
Attila. I had their shit, man. That's how big of a
Billy Joel fan I was. Showed that to me. And
he was on like electric organ through like a Marshall amp. So it's a two-man band. Him playing like organ.
And drums, too.
And there was a drummer. So it was a drummer and organ, but it was like distorted guitar-sounding organ. They had this song called Wonder Woman. It's so cheesy. You look at the album cover, they look like the Grand Funk Railroad.
Oh, God. Scary.
No, but we also listened to a lot of folk music. When I was very young, my oldest sister, who's a really great singer here in Austin, Stephanie, has... she had the albums of Carly Simon and... who was that? Was it Joan Baez, of course? And so she was listening to a lot of good female vocalists back.
Joni Mitchell,
yeah. Judy Collins, she was listening to that. And then, but you know, the folk music that we grew up, and we would sing in the car a lot together, my brothers and sisters and my mom, and when we were driving road trips and stuff. So, yeah, we listened to Pete Seeger. I wouldn't say that we were listening to Bob Dylan. No, that was a different kind of music. But stuff that was just a little bit more like the traditional.
Well, there was so much good folk. There's Peter Paul and Mary.
Yeah, Peter Paul and Mary. We had those Harry albums. Chapin, yeah. We had the Limelighters too. We had those albums.
And okay, so kind of more like the folk revival of the 50s mm-hmm. and 60s kind of bands.
Yeah, we had a very diverse amount of music to listen to. Different mm-hmm. stuff. Always.
That was a renaissance in music, the 60s and 70s. Like, oh my God, so much happened.
Yeah, yeah. Glenn Campbell was being on. Right. He was a big back in those days when I was really little. There was a Good Time Hour that he used to do with John Hartford.
Too. You had like a lot of pop country popping off at the time, too.
Yeah.
Glenn Campbell, I remember him being on Hee Haw, doing a duet with Roy Clark. And they were
Remember how awesome music was when people bought a bunch of record albums?
Remember Ghostbusters?
Remember record shops?
Yeah.
It's funny because
remember Sam Goody?
Yeah, I do. We grew up here in Austin because my mother did her doctorate at UT. And
okay.
What years were you growing?
We got here in 1968.
Oh, you lucky motherfucker! You get to see some.
How old were you though?
I was five.
You're five.
I didn't go to preschool. We had this black maid. She could call her our au pair at that time. Her name was Minnie, and I would hang out with her all the time until I was old enough to go walk to Baker because I lived in Hyde Park, Baker Elementary, which is I think now a teacher.
What street did you grow up on in Hyde Park?
I was right next door to the post office at Speedway and 43rd.
Wow.
There was an old 2-story house that eventually got sold and moved to Leander or somewhere, but it had this gigantic one side of the upper floor was my sister's bedroom. I remember painting that thing when we first got there. My uncle was there. He was there. He had done a doctorate in history at UT, but he and his wife and I specifically remember when I was six that everybody was gone. I was too young to be at the hospital when my cousin was being born.
Mm-hmm.
And she and I are the same birthday.
Yeah.
So on my birthday, I'm sitting at the table there waiting, there. But this house was this 2-story house, and it had a carport, and there was a breakfast nook right off from where the carport was,
mm-hmm.
and a laundry chute would come down from the second floor there. Mm-hmm. And it was an interesting place, and we used to go play cops and robbers on the loading dock at that post office. That post office wasn't that big as it is now, and until they bought that lot next door.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I lived across the street from that fire station there.
How long did you live in Austin as a child? Did you?
I lived here about 5-6 years until I was 11 when my mother got her first job in Beaumont. And mm-hmm.
That's where I'm from.
Really? You're from Beaumont?
I'm born in Beaumont.
We call it, oftentimes people would refer to it as the armpit of the universe because of the refineries.
Well, and also you're right at sea, you're below sea level. So
right.
It's like, imagine flooding. Austin, but hotter, more humidity. More susceptible to hurricanes.
It was always flooding. I remember playing in the water in the parking lot. It was up to my, practically my crotch, where,
mm-hmm.
well, actually probably above that because I was pretty short back, relative to where I am now.
But those Wait, are you've grown up since then?
Since childhood? I got a little taller then since I was. I was still playing pads with football in Beaumont. But yeah, it was like 3 years in Hyde Park and then 3 years in North Austin when we had to... move from there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's cool. When did you start actually playing the cello? What age?
Well, at age eight, my mother asked me if I wanted to. I thought she was talking about the string project, and it was actually the string project.
Okay, so you were in the UT string project.
I was. When I was eight, I started. I took a year of cello. We'd have a group lesson. There was a guy named David Luttrell who eventually, when I went off to college, I learned that he was in Evansville. I think I called him on the phone one time just to mm-hmm. say hi. Evansville, Indiana.
Indiana, yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
I went to Bloomington. Well, I was up there eventually.
That's another funny connection because Evansville is right across the river from Kentucky or from Louisville, right?
That's right. That's true.
Yeah. So
and you're from Kentucky.
And
yeah.
I
lived in Louisville.
I lived in Louisville. That's funny.
Yeah, but
it's a small world after all.
I stopped playing. After 1 year, I couldn't. It is. It's terribly small.
Yeah.
I'm getting cramped here. So, no, but it. Yeah. The.
So you're eight and you get you accidentally fall into what you thought was like a Barton Springs project.
Yeah, exactly, right.
Oh, go swimming a lot? Cool.
Yeah, and they don't teach you to read music. They invite you to come on Saturdays to, you know, develop that, you know, learn about reading music. But in the early going, they just put these tapes on there and they teach you songs like Streets of Laredo, or a pop song of that day was Song Sung Blue by Neil Diamond.
Yeah.
And
that's where you started?
Yeah. Like, I mean, the first song? Like, we would do a song.
Not even like something simple like Twinkle or something.
Well, right? We do, you know, they do stuff that they know the kids are going to hear on the radio.
Okay.
They do one of those, you know, not all of them, but that was one that was.
You had a frame of reference.
That's so exactly. Funny. And so what you're doing is you're listening to how the tune goes, and then you know where what number finger to use, 1, 2, 3, or 4, to put down to play, and they write the string that number of that finger belongs on. So you look at an A above the line and a D below, you know, for the top two strings, and then a G and C with a line between them.
Did they have instruments there for you guys to use?
Yeah, they did. They had you could borrow a cello from the music building at UT.
But it wasn't cellos only, this.
No, there were strings. So we had a string orchestra.
They pick for you what instrument you were going
to? They introduced you to the instruments, and I saw them. There was a big bass. There was a violin and the viola, and the cello seemed more in the middle, about my size, so I picked the cello. But I only did it for a year through the string project, and I started back up when it was an elective, when I was age 11, just before I left Austin.
Oh, okay.
And sixth grade.
That's sixth grade, so you were like in sixth grade orchestra.
And right, yeah, and that's when I started reading music more, and I was actually teaching myself stuff like Masterpiece Theater. Yeah. But I since I hadn't started reading music yet, I would write down again the same notation, like just the finger numbers.
And
I know the rhythm because you hear
tablature, they call it.
Yeah, you'd know the rhythm because you knew how the tune goes, right? Mm-hmm. And then you would just find them. And that's how I taught myself.
It's good training.
Yeah, it was
trains
fun.
Trains your ear. And
yeah.
Well, there's another, because I mean, you started for a year when you were 8. I didn't really start till I was 11 either.
Right.
So I've always felt like
some advantage when you got
a little bit, somewhat, yeah.
A little bit, yeah. But probably if you do it for a year at 8, then you take a couple of years off. Maybe not. You know, it's like
at least you knew how to hold it.
Well, here's the thing. I think
you clearly had a very musical family.
I did. So, yeah. We all sang.
You all sang.
And my brother played guitar. And yeah, my brother.
What about your folks? Did they play instruments?
My mother, only as a young, of course, she could sing, but you know. Like sing in the shower kind of singing, you know, or sing together with everybody. Of course, her family was very musical. Her father's side, the Woods, are from East, where they're from Lufkin, which is, you know, in those days, I think the Sam Rayburn Reservoir wasn't yet around. And there was like the town, parts of the town hadn't yet been covered up by that built reservoir.
Yeah.
And there was a general store called E.E. Woods General Store, Elvin Elimuel Woods.
Okay.
But there was a bunch of brothers that one of them was an organist who, his name was Guy, and he taught at Penn State at one time. And then another one played trombone. And my grandfather, Icky, they called him because he was real skinny, so he had this nickname, like he was sort of Ichabod Crane, that skinny.
Oh,
you know?
Okay.
Yeah. You know, and so his name was Grady, but
a good old name.
Yeah, he was a clarinetist.
Like Grady.
In fact, he
was Grady.
So he met my grandmother at Baylor, but yeah, those guys, they were a bunch of musicians on my mother's father's side.
Yeah.
And then my dad, who's a doctor, he actually was more of the musician of the two of them because he sang. He took voice lessons until he went off to become a doctor. And those were the days when he still had time to do that until he retired. But he's no longer around. But George Peyton Pruitt was his name. But he sang and played some guitar and saxophone. I think he played in high school. So he had definitely a love for music, and so I think that his love for music and my mother's, they saw a lot of good music together, and we brought that, even though they split up right not long after I was born, that it was we had still a lot of music in the family, so that...
Did you go to many concerts when you were in junior high and high school?
Well, what I remember concert-wise going to things is by the time we wound up in Waco, because at Baylor they had this Distinguished Artist Series, and we'd see groups like the King Singers would come as a mm-hmm. magical group.
Oh, yeah, they're great.
Oh, they're amazing.
A cappella mostly.
Yeah.
Right?
The Beaux-Arts Trio was a fine piano trio that would mm-hmm. come there and mm-hmm. perform. And, of course, you know, occasionally there was Baylor concerts that I could go to.
You never went to, like, have parents take you to see the Righteous Brothers or anything like that?
No, but my when the Doobie Brothers came to Waco, I saw them and I saw Billy Cobham once at Waco Hall. And the North Texas State Jazz Band, that was another great concert that I saw in Waco. Those were some great concerts in Waco Hall that I could go to.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, by the time I was 15, I was...
So that's another thing, I think, an interesting point of culture in America is that if you live in a college town,
yeah.
mm-hmm. like your ability, you could be in the middle of nowhere,
right?
But your ability to engage with world culture, well, maybe not world culture, but at least high culture,
uh-huh.
Is greatly expanded.
College radio too. You know? I mean, you'll hear world music on college.
Like, I think
radio
that's
sometimes.
A lot of our guests on here talk about that, about being from college towns in the middle of the Midwest, and they grew up listening to a much more expanded range of music.
There's much more community, and that's what I miss about college, and that's what I still get here in Austin mm-hmm. Through, I have to say, a lot of my friends, you included, of course, Andrew and I, through gigging. Well, what's the first time we played together? I think it was with Jason Elhoff, right?
Uh-huh.
We were probably doing a Soundbridge concert, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, possibly that, or a Will gig.
A gig? Could have been a gig with Will, I don't know.
But yeah,
that's how I got to know you more when we were
doing
that gig.
Oh, no, that was
right.
No, so
Jason,
that was the first time we ever played together
at
was Flipnotics. Soundbridge, and we did a trio I think we did... we were trying to do Baccarini.
Okay, yeah, that's right.
I think we tried to do Baccarini.
We did that, and we did some...
I'd like another swing at that one day, by the way.
Oh, man. Well,
that was
not
my proudest moment.
But then I come to realize that you play a number of different instruments, and that you toured with a band, in a band playing guitar, with a rock band for some time before you wound up here in Austin, right?
No, that's not true. No? I came to Austin directly from college, from my undergrad.
Okay.
And that's true. I was playing a guitar in a band there with my friend Jesse when we were living in the Fight Club house. And cheapest rent ever. And, but we never really quite got to the point where we were performing a lot. It was mostly just like writing music, playing music, recording our own music. I think that's where I got, that's when I first started really getting into recording. So, once I got to Austin, that's where I kind of started playing out a lot more. Cause that was, that was one of the exciting reasons to come to Austin, was that, like I said before, I think on this podcast, that I met sax players at a jazz camp who said, "You got to go to Austin because they have gigs in grocery stores in Austin." And I was like, "What? What are you talking about? What is that like?"
There's a gig that goes on at a feed store, a local feed store, and the band wears black and white and ties, and they have pedal steel, strings, horn.
Right.
And they look like they were making good money. Like, it looked like, there's no way they were dressing like that and bringing that big of a band if it wasn't good money.
Yeah, we met a guy recently at a performance at Sahara Lounge who his main thing was to become a more or less a producer or be responsible for bringing good music to farmers markets.
Yeah.
And then I heard something from another person. I think it was from one of y'all's podcasts, mm-hmm. a group that you featured. I think I was hearing you, Kirk, say how that you had heard somebody could make $500 at the Mueller. Mm-hmm. That's unheard of. I mean, that's like what you were bragging about the other day with, but But of course your band is much bigger, so right. You probably were actually pulling down a lot more than that thing.
But you think about it,
per
like,
man, you know,
yeah, with no hits, no real name. You're just maybe a acoustic guitar player and an accordion player,
right?
At a farmer's market,
right?
And they're walking home with several hundred dollars.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't know how much busking you guys have done, but when I lived in New York City, I would play in the subway, and I remember them throwing $40 in my case in an hour, and I was like so thrilled and excited about making $40 in cash thrown at you just for playing some Bach in the subway. Yeah. You know, I went to the which subway.
You might have done better than Joshua Bell did.
Probably. Oh, the cello is a little bigger sound in the subway. It's probably a little bit better traction, but I think that was kind of a. I think that was sort of a test for him. It was kind of an experiment.
Well, yeah, that was...
He didn't really need to do that.
Well, also, it was kind of PR'd out to, I think, to a certain effect. I think that particular thing, if you don't know about this was like Joshua Bell...
It was in D.C.
...played solo in a subway, and he was talking about how he was kind of, like, ignored there.
Yeah.
You know, where he's
more
like,
anonymous, yeah.
Of course, he's, like, a top-flight violin soloist, international violin soloist.
His management is Sony. He and the Yo-Yo Ma have the same management, as far as I know.
Sure. Yeah.
And interesting, but go on about the story.
Well, no, my take on that was, first of all, that it was, like... It just shows how much context makes a difference in marketing music. That if you're just some dude in the subway,
right?
And nobody knows that you're gonna be there. Nobody is particularly looking for violin music when they go to the subway. You know, it's easier to be overlooked. Whereas if you're Joshua Bell, big lights.
Right.
Solos with the symphony.
Promoted,
spending hundreds of dollars on promoting you.
And he's famous because he is amazing. He is amazing.
Well, exactly. And that he's an amazing player in both cases.
Yeah.
In other words, so this should be taken to heart by people who aren't Joshua Bell, in the sense that if you you can be amazing, but if you don't
promote
yourself or put yourself in a particular context,
right,
you're not going to draw people to your music.
That's true. It's helpful to get the kind of exposure you need, like to get on John Haley's, Eclecticos here in Austin,
right?
Or to get, it's getting kind of crazy now because now we have Facebook Live, so it almost seems like because I don't know how you feel about that, but I mean, it's not like I object to it, but here's my point, is that because it's so easy, you almost take it for granted. You're like, oh well, I'll check that out later. I can get seated at any time that I have time.
That's
to
the big change, is that we have it all at once.
Yeah.
It's overwhelming. Yeah.
It is. It's a little ridiculous, but here's the funny thing about it.
I mean, we're making a podcast in my garage right now, so it's like that's the thing. It's Amanda Palmer. I don't know if you know her.
No,
but she was kind of like, I mean, a lot of people have been doing the do-it-yourself marketing in the last 10 years. She figured out how to like basically hack Twitter and make everybody pay attention to her, and her whole point was by just like tweeting. She was just constantly tweeting. She tweeted more than some like corporations do, and they have like teams of marketers who are doing the tweets and whatnot. But anyway, her point is, we are the media. Mm-hmm. I am the media.
It's
at
true.
This point, like,
we are our local store.
That is the possibility of the internet. Now again, that doesn't mean that just because you're live tweeting that everybody in the world is going to pay attention to you, because
that's
there's
good.
A lot of other people live tweeting.
That's right. And
or live Facebooking, whatever you want to call
it. Well, it's kind of interesting.
You're broadcasting
some
yourself.
Some of the podcasts I've listened to recently are LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot to be gained, because I think that's a more of a business-focused social network media that Twitter probably is too, but we just don't perceive it that way.
Well, Twitter's Well, Twitter might disappear soon too. That's another possibility.
Why? Because
they're not making any money.
Oh, okay.
They just laid off.
They still
like,
get investors because they're successful and that people will keep giving.
Well,
them
they're hoping to get bought out right now, and they just laid off like 10% of their workforce, and so they're kind of like.
Well, it'll just be replaced by something else. It's just
sure.
Yeah, it's
well, it seems like. Facebook is doing a really good job right now.
Yeah, so they're doing better than Google Plus is, right?
Yeah, it's kind of hard to.
It's
like,
doing Google. I mean, there are people who are using Google Plus, but we just don't think of it. We probably still think of MySpace more significantly than Google Plus, right?
Yeah. Well, that's because MySpace actually had like its moment in the sun where it was number one.
Or Reverb Nation, that's probably still going on, right? Like, what do they call it? Band? What is that thing called?
Bandcamp.
Bandcamp, yeah. Mm-hmm. But you know, back to your story about Joshua Bell is kind of ironic because
that's a good joke. This
well,
podcast,
this whole media thing.
This podcast brought to you by MySpace.
this marketing thing that we're talking about, or the consciousness, or how you promote it. But I when I went off to college, I had a friend who I read a lot of chamber music with. In fact, it was probably where most of my ensembles. Playing started before I even went to Maine.
Yeah,
I started reading duets with him because he was about 3 or 4 years older than me. He was probably one of the only prominent string players in Waco that I knew. His name was Eric, and he eventually joined the Seattle Symphony, and he's up in Seattle. But Eric's parents are music teachers at McLennan Community College and Baylor, And so Eric and I would read a lot. We'd raid the Baylor Library and read all these violin and cello duets. And that's where I really developed a lot of my reading skill before we added a violist named Joey Ortiz, who taught in the Waco and Temple schools. I think he's retired from that now. And we had a trio. We called it the Brazos String Trio. In Waco, we were like the only wedding string group for the greater Waco. I was making money at age 14, 15, like several $100 doing either Jesus rock, Waco church gigs or this trio,
Right.
But that ensemble playing really paid off for me. And so back to my point about Eric went off a year or two later. I mean, because he's 3 years older than me, he went off to college and I didn't really see much of him except in the summer. So he was going to Indiana University, and his sister is my age, and so we wound up there first year. I only went there a year in Indiana, but when I got there, there were 81 incoming cellists for the incoming freshman class. There were 6 orchestras at Bloomington, Indiana, and there weren't enough orchestras for all these cellists that came there. Some people would have to sing in a choir for their large ensemble credit. So it was amazing factory, and Joshua Bell was 13 when I got there. So I go to Joseph Gingold's class. That's what I did when I slept through all my classes. I think the only classes that weren't applied music playing, well, it probably still applied, was piano, that I actually passed. But the other things were just going to all these concerts and the recital hall from like noon until midnight almost. They were going up.
Yeah.
But going to the master classes was really the education because they had these European master teachers who, one guy whose name was Menachem Pressler, who was the pianist of the Beaux-Arts Trio.
Okay.
Another guy, actually the guy Georgi Shebok was probably the best known for, ensemble, and he had a piano.
And Joseph Gingold was there.
Yeah, Joseph Gingold was teaching there.
He's a violin teacher.
And Franco Gulli was also a violin teacher there. Uh-huh. Jana Starker, who I got in the studio.
Right? Okay, Starker.
Yeah, and another guy named Fritz Mogg, who taught cello. I mean, this is gigantic. I think gigantic school of music. Mm-hmm.
I think Starker went to Florida eventually, because I think that maybe he was there before, because my...
He might have eventually, probably just because...
My orchestra director in college, I think, studied with Starker.
So oh, really? Anyway,
IU was the music, public music school, besides the conservatories. It was probably the top music school in the country.
And, if you weren't practicing and going to school, there were these great parties you can go to. Sure. And, or then there's a, you go to a gaming arcade, and occasionally I'd see Joshua Bell at Rack and Cue, I think is what we called it. and then we'd be playing Frisbee on the lawn, you know.
So played Frisbee with Joshua Bell?
Yeah, he's like 13, and I'm a tall kid, so he's jumping up on my back, riding me piggyback, and I'm like, yeah. And, you know, a few years later, I'm watching Johnny Carson show, and he's on there talking about his Corvette that he got or something, and I'm like, by the time he's, you know, 18 or older, right. You know, and... But he would play like Paganini Concerto by memory on Gingold's class, or was it Tchaikovsky? It was Tchaikovsky Concerto.
Yeah.
13. It's already playing like an adult Damn. Master. And then Joseph Gingold goes afterward. Oh, he goes, Joshua is really wonderful. Could you play Paganini? And he would play. I say, oh, Sarah, can you go get me a tab?
What is it with people in the arts in the 80s drinking tab?
I don't know. I guess this was a marketing, wasn't it?
Well, they used the cast from the TV show Fame in tab commercials.
So. I gotta
pee real quick.
Okay, right.
We'll
look for you when you come back, Kirk.
Yeah.
So
you were there, and so let's talk about a little bit more. So we've got a couple of things. So you were, you know, you started at a relatively early age, maybe not as early as some
kids.
People,
yeah, right.
But you were playing, let's talk about your pro career before you even went off to college.
Right.
How long did that last? You started at 14. Were you kind of like with that trio playing weddings and
yeah,
stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I was playing in the Baylor Symphony at age 13.
All the way until you left for college?
Until, actually, my senior year in high school, I was basically sleeping most of the day. But that was a weird thing because my cello teacher left, so I was probably
yeah,
in
it's,
depression.
It's very clear
but
that
back to the
non-music
the period,
academics were not
the
a big
period
deal.
Of, you know, 13 to 17 in Waco, I was, like, playing a string trio. I was doing these church gigs.
Yeah.
And going to Baylor Symphony three nights out of the week, I was getting a ton of exposure. I was just playing my ass off, and
time.
I wasn't. Yeah. I hadn't even yet gone to a quartet workshop yet in the summer, but that's when I really the chamber music bug really bit me is when
right.
I went to that quartet workshop in Maine with this quartet.
Yeah.
They're really fun people, the Portland String Quartet, and I think they're still going. They must be almost 48 or 49 years going now.
Wow.
Yeah, but you know the first violinist is no longer around. But
mm-hmm.
they had made music fun for me, and when I moved,
yeah.
when I wanted to get back into music at age 20 after taking a year off from college and you know, having gone to Indiana, it was a little too overwhelming.
Uh-huh.
I moved to Maine, lived there 7 years through the 80s.
Yeah,
before eventually went and got on to getting a degree. Because I was always playing. I knew that, you know, after I got out of high school and, you know, and I had done a year of college that I really needed to play the cello. And that's really what I needed to be doing, not necessarily being a college student.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really what I was doing until 1990. I finally was going back to school full time to get my degree.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't get that until 97. I spent 4 years getting all that coursework done at Urbana, Illinois,
mm-hmm.
and studied with a guy named Nathaniel Rosen. But it was really a good place to be because you're not working, you're in school, you're just doing music.
Yeah.
And there was an amazing concert hall there. I won the second concerto competition there.
You played
the Shostakovich.
Wait, that was the second concerto competition?
Yeah, I won one in Maine when I was in, you know, as a part-time music student called University of Southern Maine Chamber Orchestra Concerto Competition.
Yeah.
And played the Boccherini Concerto
in
85 doing that.
Nice.
And that was the same time that I was playing that Bach performance and, you know, getting this cello eventually.
Yeah. So that's a very, so it sounds like it was kind of like a very, like you kind of were all over the place for
a while. I
was
living in Maine for 7 years, but even after I left, I keep coming back in the summers. I must have gone to Maine 15 summers of my life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Just because, heck, I figured out, wow, you can actually be someplace where it's cool in the summer.
Oh, yeah, This is awesome. The summer in Maine is gorgeous.
It is amazing.
You know.
It's just...
I got to spend a week up there once doing, you know, during the summer in Bar Harbor, and that was really nice. But,
oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Bahaba.
So then how did you... Was the Austin Symphony the first symphony, like professional symphony?
Well, I actually got in the wake of the symphony, which, you know, when I was in high school,
sure,
age 14, 15...
Probably not a big deal to get into it.
Just the interesting thing about doing the Waco Symphony...
Exceptional that you were 15 and doing it, but...
Yeah, making money for the first time, playing in an orchestra. I was making money playing with that trio.
Yeah, right.
Before that. And this is before I was having to work in a restaurant on the weekends, you know.
Yeah.
You know, so it's always, it seemed like it was always restaurant work or gigging that, you know, you would make your money.
Well, there you go. That's being a musician.
Yeah, exactly, right? But the Waco Symphony, they would bus in people from either San Antonio or Dallas would come down and play with us in the last day, and that's what that experience was like. But it really is the chamber music that kept me as a cellist involved. I'm sorry, symphony music is not what really involves a cellist the way it involves a violinist or somebody who's playing,
right,
you know, significant parts. I mean, if you're playing modern, you know, music written more recently, yes, you know, or with, you know, in the past 150 years, those guys were doing different things that employ the cello and a symphonic repertoire than had been done before. But you're not always playing that stuff. You're usually playing the other stuff or accompanying a soloist. So your role is sort of not as important. And that's just what's so great about Austin is you got so many people who are everywhere. They want a cellist in their band, or they want...
Oh, yeah.
You know, the cello is closest to the human voice. It gets... Mm-hmm. It brings a lot of resonance and something that human beings, we can connect with. I mean, even look at it, it's almost the size of a human being.
You want to hug it, yeah.
You do. I was a guy I played at the jam recently, and he said, you look like you had your arm around a girl here, like this. I guess it appears, you know, well, you're holding it like this, you know, and it's very personable.
Do you ever fuck around with it without a boat?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, that's one thing I like about the cello is it makes, like, this great ad hoc bass.
Let's talk a little bit about a lifetime of practicing and honing your skills, because that's another, you know, that's a big deal of
important
being, especially being a classical musician.
Yeah, I'd say the first time I really, really started to get my groove with the cello on a technique level that... I must have done something right playing a Bach suite to get this cello. That helped.
Yeah.
But, you know, the suite number one by Bach doesn't have the greatest amount of technique challenge in it. It's the music, really, you know, and performing it in public and you know, doing it well, confidently. But the technique, I honed that a lot more when I went off to New York. That guy, that's Joel Martin guy, told me after a year or two, doing these solo concerts when I got this cello, he's like, where do you think you should go? You should probably get, you know, to really work more intensely on the cello. And the first thing I thought of was New York, instantly. But by then there was a guy, you know, probably the guy who most people would have gone to until he had already passed away by then was Leonard Rose in New York at Juilliard. But I got accepted into Juilliard, but I also got accepted into Manhattan School, where there was a guy named Nathaniel Rosen who had won the gold medal of the Tchaikovsky competition. So I had seen him in high school perform, and I was blown away. And so I thought, that's who I should go study with. Plus, I knew he would be performing with his Portland Quartet.
And what year was this that you...
87, fall of 87.
Okay.
And so I got into Manhattan School, and I went there for actually only a semester because I was living in Lower Brooklyn, Bay Ridge, and took 4 hours a day to commute, and and when I came back at winter, the water main had burst on the local number one, and I actually couldn't stomach even lengthening my commute longer, having to take the bus from Times Square. you know. And so I went back to Maine for two more years before I actually, you know, followed Rosen off to Urbana, Illinois. But that's where I really worked on my technique. I knew I was going to be practicing 3 and 4 hours a day, and that it would be taxing on me physically. And I knew I had some bursitis issues in this shoulder, so I'd gotten, you know, physical rehab while I was in Maine on what to do. And so I remember getting a TheraBand to strengthen the shoulder. And then when I strengthened the shoulder, I could practice pain-free for 3+ hours. Mm-hmm. And that really helped. And, you know, the things I learned from him with my technique really helped me gain a lot of ground with playing better in tune.
Yeah.
Working on an etude. He had me on the same etude for 4 months, you know, working on a concerto. And yeah, things were really ringing in my ear, just mm-hmm. like where the pitch belongs. Mm-hmm. And things were becoming more easy with a bow, using a more compact bow, focusing my sound. And
yes,
and
that's what you've been yelling at me about.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm a string player, as we think we can hear the grass grow. So I'm in another room and I hear him practice. I'm like, hey, can I help? You know, let's talk about pitch. You know, where does the pitch belong? And it's funny because you can hear string players, you can tell when they think they're playing flat, they start playing sharp. Or when they think they're playing sharp, they start playing flat. and then we have these tendencies to kind of overdo things, you know? Yeah.
Well, and the mind plays tricks on you.
It does.
It's
but
hard to...
I mean, I play in a symphony where we tune at 441, so my tendency might be able to aim a little high on the pitch. It might not be sharp in the real world sense, but it might be on the sharper side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I have to actually train myself occasionally to tune it back to 440 when we're not doing the symphony stuff. Or if you're playing with an organ that's tuned flat, you've got to tune down to match the organ. Or if you're playing with a piano that is not up to pitch, you've got to match the piano. So you've got to listen to what's going on around you and fit with it. That's your job as a musician, is to conform and have a dialogue with other musicians.
And we're not all not everyone's soloing at once.
Yeah.
Well, that's for sure.
That's
certainly.
Get out of the way. Get out of the way.
Where you owe your... It's like any society, any group thing. You owe your part to it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, and also, that's the other... I mean, when you're playing classical music, your part is prescribed. You know, you must play with a part. Mm-hmm. And to me, like, we were having this conversation the other day that what I listen for in those, and really in any musical situation, but especially in classical situations, is, am I fitting in? Mm-hmm. Like, do I... when I can hear my sound melding with everything else, that's good. When I hear me sticking out, I begin to worry. Mm-hmm. Or, and also if I'm, you know, obviously not, you know, like, again, back to the groove thing. You know,
yes.
I'm not just talking about pitch. I'm also talking about, like, other things. But then the other thing is...
The feel, yeah.
When you play in chamber groups, I feel like that's the, if you, you know, like, you have to decide when you're going to make a comment about something that you think the group should change.
Yeah.
And to me, that's what I listen for. If I'm doing my best to fit in with everybody else,
right,
but yet still something is bugging me, there's something that I can't jive with, or some other person is not jiving the way it should.
Yeah.
That's when I feel like I should say something in a nice way
about it.
And then also, or, you know, that's to me, like, that's determines my aesthetic is this a cohesive sound, is the most important thing when we're playing together.
Yeah.
As far as like technical, you know, then of course there's a million ways that you can, interpret that, right?
Yeah.
Because you can, because then it's like, it's not about like, because the other thing is like, it's not about, it's not about being right, it's about being together, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, and then it doesn't matter, you can do whatever you want with the music, you know? Like, but as long as we're all doing it together.
Yeah, as long as it's fitting in the landscape of the music that is, you know, it's in the key and the some of the things you're doing rhythmically fit with each other. I think that's what I listen for, trying to create a rhythmic counterpart or fit within the tonal ladder of what I'm doing. Like, this is something I learned more from. If I'm not playing music, you know, the music that I listen to now, not that what I was doing when I was growing up, I listen to bebop. That's the stuff for me. Mm-hmm. That is the kind of jazz that's dark and beautiful
and complicated.
It's kind of crooning, yeah. And it's a little bit avant-garde for its time. Mm-hmm, it was, but
Even look, still today,
today it probably is. And people probably don't really understand what Thelonious Monk is. Mm-hmm. He was really. Probably, he and Duke Ellington were probably...
Oh, Thelonious and Duke are in their own universe.
Yes, now, they were composers who were jazz players. And this is another thing you find out, that the guys who wind up studying to become composers are jazzers. Mm-hmm. Those guys,
a lot
that's
of them.
Where they don't... that's where they really get their feet wet with knowing what to listen for and how to make... something interesting happened.
They know how to put tell Andrew, like, when you're picking out a part for a jazz number, you really got to put the piss and vinegar in there.
Blue note in there.
Well, jazz is, if anybody, you know, like, to me, if you want to do pop music, you know, you want to say like playing bands and stuff.
Yeah,
you should probably really study jazz. Because it's the most advanced of the pop formats.
Mm-hmm, right.
It has the most rich harmonic language.
Right.
It has the most rich rhythmic language.
Yeah.
And all of the music that was made post-World War II is in some way influenced by jazz. Mm-hmm. Because it was... We don't think of it as much now, but in the 40s, 50s, 60s... jazz was just as prevalent, and in fact maybe more so, than rock and roll and folk music.
It's probably the only genre that casts a bigger shadow than rock and roll. It's in so many different styles under
the
roof.
Well, and this is something that we usually associate with big band.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And because that's what was, I think, World War II period.
Well, that was the popular dance music at that time.
Yeah, what would you call that? The time, what was that called? The Prohibition days. Mm-hmm. The 20s, 30s. And on end, that it just was, they were doing a lot of big band performing, and those, but the African Americans, or the, you know, some of the, those who were descendants of they got brought over here as slaves, they definitely, they had their gospel or spiritual music, and then jazz kind of grew out of that, really.
Yeah.
Sure.
And the stuff they were mixing with it in New Orleans, that was the best.
Well,
New Orleans and Harlem are the two, like, great mixing pots of, you know, foreigners coming in. So they were mixing clog with jazz, uh-huh. just like in blues and all those things.
Let's just be real, though. The reason why jazz is what it is because it was the outlet for the best musicians in the African American community. That's what it was.
Yeah.
Like, they can't go to Harvard and Yale.
Right.
They can't
go to
you know, they can't study with European masters, and they can't get into symphonies. You know, they can't, you know, so there's no options for them because of racism.
Yeah.
But that's also because there's no options, they look to their own culture, and then they build something from that, which is awesome. You know, that's, to me, that's the beautiful story of jazz, is that it's you know, when life gives you lemons, you make amazing bebop jazz. And so that's the thing, that's what, you know, that's why everybody needs to and again, if you want to do pop music, you got to go there, because there's a great example of people who make music from their own community, for themselves, and it becomes amazing. And that's the secret to great pop music.
Right,
you know,
it's bringing your culture and, you know, enriching your local experience through sharing what you have, you know, your own background, your own musical training, what you hear what you hear inside your own ear,
yeah,
that makes sounds that people can interact with, you know, mm-hmm. when they're doing music with you.
Yeah.
And that for me is what keeps me going is having that experience. That's why I enjoy on Monday nights being late over at Halcyon.
Well, which is technically a world jazz jam. Isn't that what they technically call it? Global world jazz jam.
Yeah, yeah. Where I'll go hang with Roberto and my friends, my world music friends that I've gained through that experience.
Although the real jazziness of it is maybe a little.
it's sort of. You know, what you find oftentimes is that, you know, you can hear the training, Roberto's training, he went and studied in India, and so I learned more about quarter tones and microtonal music and different makams, bayati, and rags that he has studied, and when I go hear his band, I love hearing that band here in Austin, Attash.
Attash, yeah.
But yeah, it's... But man, we heard some good Indian music
sure
last
did.
Week
Let's
at
Indrajit.
Who's but yeah, we went to hear. I saw a Santur player whose
That's
name is
definitely the highlight of my last week.
Yeah, what was his name? Sandeep Chatterjee.
Okay.
He was here touring. He's a master Santur player, and then a locally well known. What was the tabla player's name?
I can't remember.
Gosh, why can't I think of that? I'm blocking on that right now. But
and then also a violinist who's Indradeep.
I didn't get Indradeep's last name. Banerjee.
No, that's
Indrajit's last name.
Sorry, I've got it here on my phone because I was. I did. Indradeep Ghosh.
Right.
Indradeep Ghosh. And he plays, which he's very interesting because he's playing a five string. Violin with eight resonating strings that's based on it's a violin, so it's based on a European instrument, but a viola d'amour,
right,
which is a, you know, archaic instrument. It's not one that's used in the symphony or anything.
No,
like
it's
that.
Something would be like,
but it's
even
perfect.
older than the Baroque period.
Perfect. It's like it's almost designed for Indian music because of all the resonating strings. It gives it that kind of like, you know, somewhere between a sitar and a kora or something like that. It fits in with those other Indian string instruments that have a lot of resonating instruments. Or even the, what's the one I've been listening to a lot? The, that Ali Akbar Khan plays. It's really great. And yeah, that jam was just...
Is
off
that,
the chain.
Yeah, it was. And but
and you, I was so honored to be around those.
Yeah, it wasn't
types
fun.
Of players.
And then you know, a few other.
And then Jason.
People. Jason
and,
showed up, and then Fareed came.
Fareed
Safinouri.
So yeah, to get to play that sort of music and that's with those sort of masters.
Highly, yeah, they're all from Calcutta, India. These three guys and. What you found is that, you know, I just watched the tabla player and the santur player, that they were the guys who were performing the house concert before we came later
right.
to jam with them, and that they really knew how to build the music and the, you know, the tabla is a tuned drum, and so he's getting this amazing resonance from these two instruments that and the santur player, you know, it looks like a hammer dulcimer, but one hand he's like got a little light hammer in one hand, and then he's picking the other, so it's like three rows of strings on either side of the tuning heads.
Uh-huh.
And I guess he said there's about 2.5 octaves on the santur that he has.
Yeah.
He's just fantastic. The guy has an ear to
an ear
find
that...
a scale and a tune.
Yeah.
And build and understand the parameters within which he can manifest a melody and,
mm-hmm.
and rhythm. That's
mm-hmm.
basically it, I think. And I think that's what the Indian style of music is, that they take the principle of rhythm and melody and expand on them, but keep that within a larger structure that is maintained.
Well, yeah, yeah.
And then there's a sort of a spiritual place which within it that it's so pure that Mm-hmm. You can't help but be taken along on the ride. And what is this droning instrument that they keep going while they're playing?
It's the
hurdy-gurdy?
No. That's totally a European instrument. What's it called? It's another S instrument. Anyway, but the ding dong. It's the thing. It sounds like almost.
You can't sound be phased in and out of it.
Yeah, like, you're sounding like a Mongolian throat singer right now. But yeah, I'll look it up. We'll figure it out. But anyway, but you have a drone that stays the whole time. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's lovely.
They keep that going.
Lovely.
And it's kind of like, what? Could somebody turn that thing off when y'all are not performing? I have tinnitus. At times, I need my ears.
Oh, and you can't tell that it's not off.
I need no more stimulation for my ears.
Right now. For sure. The drone and the idea that they stay in one scale for an entire composition, mm-hmm. and they stay in one rhythmic pattern for an entire composition, but that sounds like it would be limiting, but it's not, because they are seems to me the point of it is to explore the farthest reaches of
stretch the boundaries without ever falling apart.
So it's like a great conversation where you stay focused on one thing,
yeah,
and you just keep going and mm-hmm. going and going until you've built up
this yeah thing. But you got like we've been doing, you go on such a tangent that you know you just can't help but be dragged along. You just want to go there. You just got to do it, and that's what makes us live and be alive. I finally remember the guy's name, Gauri Shankar.
Gauri Shankar.
That's the tabla player. Yeah. Really amazing tabla player.
Very good.
Just really brings everything alive. Such a nice guy too. Really a very
warm guy.
An upstanding gentleman when you're around people who bring that energy, that's what makes life worth it. You know, you get to interact with people who, that there's no negative energy.
Yeah.
It's so beautiful.
You get
it?
That from Rajmani.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Peaceful vibe.
Yeah, I think there must be something in Indian culture that they have. They seem to know.
Well, I don't know if you remember.
Leave their bullshit at the door.
Well, also,
it's a good way to put it.
Well, it's the idea of namaste, which is I honor the God within you. They have a polytheistic view of things where God or gods are in
their ego is not here.
Because they know that they're part of like this big pool of consciousness that they're just going to be, you know, thrown back into and drawn again. You know, that's the idea of reincarnation.
Happiness is available. Yeah, you can sense that when you're talking to Indrajit that mm-hmm. there's he's a happy man.
Yeah,
you know he's. And that's cool.
It's available for download. Yeah. Anytime you want to accept the terms of use, it's there.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Very well. Well, said.
Well, and there are no terms.
Speaking of happiness for download, would it be appropriate to hear some happy Bach?
Yes.
I was going to say, let's do a musical number.
Do some beautiful Bach.
Let me give you a prelude.
We opened with a jam, and then we'll close this out with some Bach.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's. Let's stop here and let me rearrange so we get the best sounding Bach possible. Very good talk.
Yeah,
lovely
that was
talk.
Good, yeah.
All over the place, but
it's a good podcast.
All over the good places.
Well, that's what I've noticed listening to y'all's podcast, that there's some good conversation going on.
Well, we like to talk.
Yeah, so I've been working on this project for years, but I've gotten one CD done.
Okay.
The first, third, and fourth suites, and the second suite needs some editing. And I'm busy trying to finish recording the fifth and sixth suites. So this I'm about to play is Bach wrote it for a five-string cello called a cello piccolo, and I'm playing this on a four-string cello. It's the suite number 6 in D major. The prelude, the first movement by J.S. Bach, and I'd love to be able to announce the finished second volume soon.
Okay. Of the suites.
Yes.
Cool. All right, so we're gonna. Well, let's get quiet here, and then.
But for the time being, people can still download, I think, digitally from charlespruitt.com. CharlesPrewitt.com.
Very good.
.com.
The first volume of the Sweets.
Okay. Of Latter-day Saints. All right. Well, we'll be quiet while you take it away whenever you're ready.
Thank you.
Fuck yeah. That's
awesome, man. Thanks.
Well done, Charles.
I had to get my guitar out so it could just...
It's a resonate. Vibration. Yeah. Resonance.
Thanks again, Charles.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
That'll be it for today.
Awesome.